The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Americans do not understand yet how easy it is for that to snowball. The natural tendency will be for that to slide towards security and towards statism. So unless you actually actively push against it, it's going to slide that way. And what I see is a lack of interest in pushing against it. And I think it's already gone too far and it's accelerating in the wrong direction faster.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and part two of our Becker Pulverini interview. One of the things Becker said that I really ruminated on is when you're online, when you're in the electronic universe, if you're getting something for free, you're the product.
When now we have some of the key contributors in the social media space saying we have deliberately created and consulted with the best psychologists available to create a sticky environment where you get in and you can't get out. It's almost like the gambler with an addiction problem walking into a casino and being lost in the maze. And so what do? You just bounce around like a pinball from one table to the next, spending every last dollar you
have. You can check in, but you can never leave.
That's right. Well, yeah. And social media has done the same thing.
Yeah.
What they've done is created the perfect environment to then monetize, as you just suggested, monetize you, the person who's there. The captive audience is the audience that gets marketed to.
And the difficulty is, you know, we need technology. You know, I know there's some who say, well, look, I just don't have the internet. I'm not going to touch any of that stuff. But we're living in a universe where you really can't even check your bank account without being online. So in a way, we're stuck.
Well, this is a digital world that we live in. Mary Catherine, my wife, went to Boston College, and one of her philosophy professors was an anti-tech guy. He rode his bike to school, even in the snow. He did not have a social security card. He never had a credit card. He did not have a passport or a driver's license. He could not leave the United States. He didn't have the ability to buy a home. He had no credit, but it was his protest vote against a world that was impinging on him and what he believed were certain rights to privacy. We've redefined privacy rights. We've defined that as an important aspect sociologically, but I think what we haven't discovered yet is the depth of impact psychologically that many of the medias that we engage with or mediums that we engage with, the effect that they have on us long term.
Well, and you need to ask him about sociological as well.
Well, transitioning, you know, social media, and this is kind of moving away from blockchain and whatnot, social media and social consequences. There is a shift in how information is flowing online, whether it's search or social media. Everyone thinks of Facebook, I think, but you have algorithmic editing of searches and information to match the user. I think there are like 57 signals that you're constantly sending to Google, and they know what data to put in front of you in terms of a ranked listings when you do a search, when you're looking for something. Let's discuss that. I mean, we've essentially moved from a broadcast society to where everyone has their own blog, social media post, YouTube video, and we've gone away from the old methods of information distribution. Editors of newspapers, they were sort of the information gatekeepers, and it seems that the torch has passed from a human gatekeeper to computers or algorithms. And it makes me wonder about ethics, the judgment and selection process for our computer algorithmic curated world. What are your thoughts?
In my mind, this is sort of the logical extension of the, I feel like such a cynic today, but a logical extension of kind of the 24-hour news cycle. So, you know, when kind of news becomes entertainment, then the human brain doesn't like confusion. It's perceived as pain, effectively. So you don't want to confuse your audience. And if you can say things that appeal to them, they're more likely to be happy, which means they're more likely to consume, right? And I feel like what Google and this algorithmic curation of content, particularly with Facebook essentially being like a digital editor for the world's biggest newspaper, you know, except it's entirely controlled by algorithms. What we're seeing in my mind is a sort of logical extension of this. It's like, okay, well, if we want to sell them textual advertising, we certainly don't want them angry at us for having presented them this content. So we should make sure to present content that they like, that they're, you know, in a good mood or more willing to support people that support their political viewpoint. And we're able to take some of the float on that. So I think because of that financial motivation, they're highly incentivized to not offend. And I think what we're seeing with social media is, and this is obvious, is sort of this echo chamber. And people are wondering, wow, how did this happen? How is it the case that my crazy uncle that, you know, says weird things at Thanksgiving is now saying it twice as often on the internet with more vitriol? And I think the reason why is because when you're in that highly like agitated emotional state, you're a little bit more susceptible to being persuaded to take certain actions. And these companies like Google and Facebook know they're doing this. They have teams of psychologists and user interface designers and user experience people that literally sweat blood trying to figure out how to get people to click on these links. And I think this is all part of this like kind of horrible Steinbeck-esque machine that's kind of getting us just buy more stuff. And I think the negative externality of that process is our political discourse is getting worse, and we're kind of getting siloed off into these echo chambers.
That's a big topic in itself. I mean, it seems like civil society can more easily become uncivil if we all live in echo chambers and never practice the art of dialogue. How do we support civility and reasoned debate in an age where we're surrounded by information that's relevant according to personalized algorithm, important according to our routine searches, and not balanced with anything that's uncomfortable or challenging in terms of a point of view, another point of view from our own? How do you support civility and reasoned debate in that age?
Wow, that's a great question. I don't have a good answer for that. I would like to assume that it would be like good digital stewardship and relying on the kindness of Google and Facebook to realize sort of the negative externalities of what they're doing. There might need to be some sort of like expose that really scares people into demanding maybe changes to laws to force them to do it. But then again, you run into other issues of freedom of speech, and it's a very complicated, I don't have to tell you this, but it's complicated. It is not my area of expertise, but I sure do hope somebody figures out how to answer that question, because technologists and engineers in particular, right, they sort of ask, is it possible? They don't necessarily ask, what are the negative externalities of having done it in the first place? It's just, it's common. Everybody since Oppenheimer, right, with the atomic bomb has sort of struggled with these questions. And I know that in Silicon Valley, there's kind of an attitude of kind of don't ask, don't tell, you know, sort of just don't ask these questions, just kind of increase the valuation of your company, get more daily active users, and then, you know, donate to a hospital. And I think that attitude towards technology is really dangerous, but I think the only way it's going to solve it is by starting to throw people in prison.
You've got the customized news and search results, and this does affect where we live and who we become as a society, as a people. I wonder about the civil society implications. Are democratic institutions challenged by their constituents living more and more in a tailored box or a tailored bubble? How is democracy transformed through the manipulation or modification of data? I mean, we talk about the profit motive with big companies, but there is this effect. There is this effect where these are voting people. These are thinking or should be thinking people. You actually end up with quite a bit of control in the hands of the companies that are crafting the message.
Yeah, I mean, it's really scary to think about handing over democratic discourse to corporations. Like, if you phrase it like that, people are like, whoa, that sounds horrible. We should not do that. But if you phrase it in the context of, well, you know, would you be willing to just use this app that sends you news articles you like? You say, oh, that's great. I like that. So I feel like what we're not realizing in society is the interrelationship between those two things, the sort of degradation of our democratic discourse by handing it over to algorithms that are owned by companies that have a major motivation to appease their shareholders. That's something that I don't think like the founders of the Constitution ever really thought about. They thought about a lot of stuff, but I don't think that's something that the founders had when they were thinking about, say, the US Constitution. I don't think they had any conception that there would be like a medium of communication that would be able to ignite or incite that kind of activity. And I think things have to probably get worse before the government begins to take action. But I think there needs to be laws to protect our democratic discourse, or we're really going to pay for it. I don't know of any technological solutions to this problem, short of having laws that change the algorithms, because since it's controlled by an algorithm, there's no like person responsible, which is even more terrifying. It's like we have no one to hold accountable now. It's just math. It's cosine distance, k-means clustering, like all these algorithms that are used in machine learning, just sort of floating out there. And how do you put that on trial? You really can't. So we have to be careful about how we craft the laws, but I think it's absolutely essential to preserving civil society and democratic discourse.
Within the free market system, there was checks and balances. And I think something shifted pretty dramatically when we started to emphasize limited liability versus unlimited liability. Consider how differently JP Morgan is managed than Brown Brothers Harriman. The principals at Brown Brothers Harriman have unlimited, they have purposefully maintained unlimited liability. JP Morgan and Jamie Dimon, anything happens bad to the company, who is on trial? Is it the entity? Is it the CEO? Is what went wrong? Do you end up getting to fire the low man on the totem pole and, you know, sort of kick the dog on the way out the door? We changed the capital structure and put more of an emphasis on profit instead of sustainability in so doing. And now all of a sudden, free markets have really begun to see much more of a degradation, a corruption within capitalism. And it doesn't allow for a natural counterbalancing of incentives. I mean, I think of a board meeting at Brown Brothers Harriman, not that I've ever sat in one, but I can imagine them being much more philosophical and reflective about the implications of their business, because ultimately, if something goes wrong, it rolls right back uphill to them. And so being much more cognizant, rather than saying, hey, look, we've got our quarterly earnings numbers to meet, and everybody's just running full out to beat last quarter's numbers.
Right. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head. You know, computer scientists have this saying, you know, everything can be solved with an additional layer of abstraction. And it's true. In computer science, we're in the abstraction making business. That's all we do all day, is we take these logical castles and we try to abstract them away into something very simple. And when I look at what's happening with technology, I see the work of computer scientists in it, right? It's like, okay, we've abstracted away all human agency from this process. So it's this perfect machine that's just floating out there. Boy, look at how efficient it is. But now, like you said, there's no human agency in it anymore. There's no moral questions. Computers are not moral machines. They are algorithms. They're like a clock. You know, they're not like a person. And that to me is just so terrifying, because it's especially terrifying when computers dictate to humans how certain things should go, as opposed to the other way around. It's frightening to think that, for example, if Google sends like a, just a crazy example, Google News feeds a future school shooter a large collection of, you know, right-wing neo-Nazi type content because they want that content. And then that person is motivated to go shoot a school, you know, full of children. Is Google responsible for having sort of inflamed those sensibilities in the process of trying to sell them textual advertising? The link is tenuous, but even still, I don't really get the vibe that these companies are being genuine about reflecting on the implications of things like that from their technology.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. Like you said, abstracting away from human agency. It's the same issue when we're talking about social media. You get the age-old question, what is truth? And it's sidelined for personal relevance, which personal relevance is now outmaneuvering or preceding the pursuit of truth. You know, why? Because we want something that's personalized. And the consequence is sort of reinforced subjectivity. Forget objective truth. I'm happy with my small R reality, not big R reality, not some meta reality. And the technology is there to reinforce it, even if our subjective reality is corrupted, nasty, and ultimately harmful to people. But as you say, there's no real tie out to who's responsible.
Yeah.
I think we're disengaged from the machine we created. It's beginning to feel a little bit like Frankenstein, this beautiful beast, and we just don't know what happens next.
Yeah. And man, that should be terrifying to people. Like, maybe I feel like I'm a paranoid cybersecurity guy, but you know, technology doesn't feel anything. It's not going to have remorse. So it's good that humans are involved in these decision-making processes. Yes, it's inefficient, but humans are gifted with the ability to make moral judgments. And it's very important. And I think your point about being able to create these sort of silos of subjective reality as opposed to getting at objective truth is exactly fine for these companies, because if they can craft a subjective reality that gets you to buy more, then they win. So they have no incentive to present you objective truth. They have incentive to get you to feel motivated to buy more stuff. So they're entirely these machines designed to motivate consumer behavior. And if you were to phrase it that way to people, like, hey, what if your news source was entirely motivated to just get you to buy stuff on Amazon? You'd be like, that seems kind of weird. I feel like, shouldn't they be motivated by the pursuit of truth and by journalistic integrity? Like, well, I mean, yeah, but that's not what the machine can do. The machine can only figure out whether or not you're likely to buy this thing on Amazon. They're like, well, that seems like a bad machine. But you don't really get that feeling from the companies that they're really trying to think about it in a way. Think about it in terms of promoting objective truth, as opposed to just saying, we're creating a subjective reality that gets you to be more likely to buy something.
So we shifted from a little bit of public policy, international relations, over to social media and social consequences. I want to come back around to some of the work that Citizen Labs has done up at Toronto. In Canada, they have the Communication Security Establishment, which is a Canadian agency. It's a part of the Five Eye Alliance, bringing together New Zealand, Australia, the UK, the US, and Canada to share data. And at one point, their focus was on diplomatic issues, military information, government communications. But today, when you look at these governments getting together and sharing information, the focus is not on military, diplomatic, and government communications. It's on all communications throughout society. Does that reflect the NSA's move from sort of interest in some data to interest in all data? What's a healthy response to the emergence of the NSA, you know, spying on Congress and on U.S. citizens? This is all data, right? And it's all for our safety that it's being analyzed and looked at. But how should we respond to, wait a minute, do you even have the right to do this, to get this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly that. Asking that question, wait a minute, do you even have the right to do that? Like, that is the first step. The first step is getting our democracy to ask that question, like look inside and say, okay, do I really value security over my privacy this much? If the answer is yes, then just keep doing what you're doing. Because the truth of the matter is, this technology does make the nation more secure from like a terrorism perspective. In my opinion, it doesn't make it more secure from a death of democracy perspective, but it does make it more secure from like a, how likely is this person to go shoot up a school? How likely is this person more likely to blow up an airport? You know, you can actually ask those questions and you can get actionable intelligence from all this monitoring. An interesting example of this is what China is doing in Xinjiang and Western China with the Muslim ethnic minority there and all of the censorship and surveillance they're putting those people under. They're doing it, and it has been able to essentially completely clamp down on the promotion of a lot of, you know, these radical elements, radical terror cells that were forming in other parts of Central Asia and the Middle East. They've been able to tamp that down, but at what cost, right? The Chinese government obviously made that choice for their people, but as Americans, we need to ask that question. The second thing is, I don't really hold the NSA responsible for this. I don't think it's like the NSA started this process. I think this is just something that fell out of two trends. The first is, like I said, storage became cheap, so we just started having more data. And the second is computers got faster, so we started being able to analyze more of it. I think because of those two trends, the NSA did what they did, Google does what they do. It just seems like that's the logical thing that follows out of those two trends for government agencies and for corporations. I think as consumers, what do we do about it? I think we have to choose to do business and cooperate with companies the same way you might go to the supermarket and see that something is organic. If you go to the supermarket, you're like, oh, that's organic food, or oh, that's non-GMO, or that's, you know, sustainably raised or whatnot. I think we need to make the same choices about our technology. Like, oh, this uses end-to-end encryption. Oh, this is a company that has a great track record of resisting law enforcement when they overreached. Oh, this company puts their data center in a country that I trust that has good privacy laws. You know, we have to make those same decisions as consumers and as citizens to work in countries, choose products, cooperate with people that reflect those things in the same way we might about food. But I think ultimately this trend isn't really the product of the NSA and like the Five Eyes becoming more evil. I think they just looked at the writing on the wall and they're like, we got more storage, we got more data, let's do something with it. And a ton of evidence that shows that it actually does work. It just works at the cost of destroying our privacy.
Right. So, I mean, but you contrasted two things. One, we end up with a more secure world where we have actionable intelligence and can see terrorism coming, anticipate, get in front of and stop it. But that is in contrast to the death of democracy or what we want to be the healthy constituent parts of our democracy. And I think of autocratic regimes who can take today commercial spyware and use it against citizens anywhere in the world. This comes back to your one of the first things that you said today, which is people make the mistake of assuming something that is completely time bound, right? So today you trust your government. Today you trust your government. But with these tools, how does an autocratic regime threaten journalists, eliminate lawyers, pressure human rights activists, destroy religious groups? I mean, all of these things are, if you assume that they are an erosion of democracy, they are actually wonderful tools for status. And again, I maybe these are questions for Machiavelli rather than Polverini, but I'm just wondering if this is where we have to keep a strong conversation alive. What kind of democracy do we want?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think this is the single most important question in American democracy right now. And I know that's a bold claim, but yes. So that dialectic I sort of proposed of like a perfectly secure society with no privacy and a perfectly private society with, I would argue, limited security, not no security. But there is that spectrum. And I obviously have my own viewpoint on this, but I think ultimately the beauty of a democratic society is we get to figure out where we want to sit on that. But what gives me pause or what gives me a great deal of fear about posing this question in a democratic setting is I feel like Americans do not understand yet how easy it is for that to snowball. So even if you make that choice to be at a certain position on the spectrum, the natural tendency will be for that to slide towards security and towards statism. So unless you actually actively push against it, it's going to slide that way. And what I see is a lack of interest in pushing against it. And I think it's already gone too far and it's accelerating in the wrong direction faster. Another thing besides your data being time bound is what if Russia and the United States share intelligence with each other? Russia has no qualms about privacy. So if Russia is tapping its citizens and giving that data to the United States, is that not a violation of privacy for those citizens? And, you know, if we get information about Russian citizens in the United States or the United States shares it with, you know, maybe U.S. citizens living in Russia to the Russian government, like we're having even the case that even if a country has strong data privacy laws, it might share it with a country that has less strong, or it might use a country that has less strong privacy laws to help bolster a relationship with a country that has strong ones. So it's sort of this thing where wherever it degrades, it kind of degrades everybody around it as well. And I think we need to be very clear-eyed about the fact that we are, you know, playing with something very dangerous when we decide we're willing to give up privacy for a little bit more security. It is definitely give an inch, they take a mile sort of thing.
Well, I'm going to end our conversation today with a question that I did ask in June, which is, do you have any literary aspirations? Because I think people understand the issues if they're laid out in story form. If it gets too technical, people just don't care. They move on very quickly to, I got to pick up the kids from soccer, or I'm hungry, what time is dinner? You know, but in a story form, you can begin to paint the reality. And I think perhaps if you haven't considered, maybe you should.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, it's funny when you asked that question in June, it did kind of get me thinking. I know for our company, for example, we have a blog. I'm going to start blogging on some of these issues just in a very lightweight fashion, just because I have finally been pushed off the edge. I think this is such an important issue that even though I am not literary, I'm 100% an engineer. I still feel like I have something to contribute to the discourse as a technologist to maybe help people understand that, you know, this isn't magic, like they're just algorithms, but by that same token, even though they're not magic, they're still incredibly powerful. And if we can get a better understanding of how this technology affects our lives, then I think we can try to have our cake and eat it too. We can try to have these incredibly powerful technologies, you know, promoting human well-being while at the same time trying to just make sure we can function as free creatures with volition and with the ability to make the moral choices we want.
Well, you're not just an engineer, just like T.S. Eliot was not just a banker. I look forward to seeing what you write. And tell us if people are interested in looking at the blog as and when you get that cranked up and written in a format that regular humanoids can read, not engineering or cryptographers. Where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find us at pkcsecurity.com. We're going to be releasing a new blog in the next couple weeks. And it's, if you go to it now, you're going to see a bunch of content on very complicated cryptography issues that are totally irrelevant to this audience. But in the next 2 weeks, we're going to start bringing in content that's written for humans. And hopefully it's entertaining and hopefully it helps elucidate some of the trends and some of the issues that we're seeing in the market and in government.
Becker, I think we care about a lot of the same things under the surface, who we are, where we're going as a country. And I appreciate your contribution today. Look forward to our future conversations as well. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, same. Thank you so much. This is a really great conversation.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Becker Polverini. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, and you can always call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.